Hello, everybody. I'm Jacob Dettori, and this is the FBI podcast. The president of the United States, Donald Trump, has made of sanctions a distinctive element of his foreign policy. In fact, sanctions appears to have become his foreign policy weapon of choice. He used them against China, Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, and others, causing geopolitical backlash and more than a headache for foreign investors around the globe. Matt Horstmann, here with me in our studio in London to discuss ways for foreign investors to mitigate sanctions risks as much as possible. Matt is a partner with law firm Pillsbury and an expert in compliance with U.S. and international sanctions and international law in general. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I guess it's been pretty busy lately since Donald Trump rose to power, right?
Yes, it's not been it's been a heyday for sanctions lawyers.
So tell us, what the level of aggressiveness of the White House through economic sanctions has skyrocketed since Donald Trump entered the rose to the presidency. So you want to tell us, give a brief overview of what has changed from his predecessors and how he's using sanctions as part, as a key element of his foreign policy.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely correct that sanctions has become the primary, if not one of the primary weapons of the Trump administration in foreign policy terms. They've used sanctions extensively in major number of geographies and against many different situations. Just as one, you know, data point, that the number of individuals and companies that are on the U.S. sanctions list, the so-called specially designated nationals, has more than doubled since the Trump administration came to power. They're using it very actively. And it's still a concern, particularly American companies and American investors know how to handle this. But I think the impact this is having on foreign businesses is grown, you know, significantly. For example, knowing which companies you can deal with, as if you're an investor sitting in London, you're not a U.S. citizen, but sanctions do have an impact across the board, whether that's, you know, your investments in Russia, Iran, Venezuela. I can't imagine you have too many investors looking at North Korea, but these different places, there are U.S. regimes that do impact on what you can do.
Sure. And actually, he also introduced the new elements, or anyway, elements that were not really very common in the past, like exports control sanctions, or also like secondary sanctions targeting non-US companies, which were in place also before he came into power. But his and his administration have been very committed when it comes to enforcing them. But let me start digging a bit deeper, talking about China-U.S. Relations and this unfolding trade feud, if you want, between the two countries. As mentioned, there are no typically traditional treasury sanctions slapped on Chinese companies or individuals, but there are President Trump introduced export control sanctions that have got some new elements here and there and are definitely differ from the past. So you want to give us an idea of what it means really for anybody dealing with China?
Yeah, absolutely. That there's, as you pointed, there's sort of three big areas where the Trump administration has changed, and that's the export control being number one, the use of the Global Magnitsky Act number two, and the use of these so-called secondary sanctions. But taking the export controls first, a lot of people don't realize there's Treasury Department sanctions, but there's also Commerce Department export controls, which are, in effect, sanctions. And these are limits on what U.S. technology can be exported overseas. These are usually control technologies or dual-use technologies that are highly technologically advanced or could have a military application. But it doesn't just limit U.S. companies exporting these equipment overseas. It limits say European companies who integrate American technology into their equipment or their widget or their technology or software and then exporting it. So with China, what the Trump administration has done is not sanction them directly in the traditional way like with Iran or Russia, but has started imposing export restrictions on U.S. technology. You've seen this in the Huawei case is the most prominent one where U.S. companies have been limited in what they can sell to Huawei, and that's had a major knock-on effect, not just in the U.S., but also the Huawei's global supply chain. You've seen it recently with the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, where there's been technology restrictions on the export of U.S. technology to companies in China that have issues or operate in Xinjiang. And this has become a major tool. It's sort of a corollary to the trade war that's going on between the U.S. and China, and as a way to sort of hit at China, for the Trump administration to hit at China in a way that's not sanctioned directly. That doesn't mean the U.S. doesn't sanction Chinese companies, and they have sanctioned Chinese companies for their dealings with Iran or North Korea, particularly in the energy side or the shipping side. But they've avoided a kind of frontal sanctions assault and have using export controls as a way to do this.
And I imagine that for non-U.S. companies, this means a big effort in trying to track each single supplier along their supply chain and being sure that they are not in breach of these export control sanctions, right?
Exactly. A European company, for example, that imports U.S. technology, integrates into their widgets and software, has to be very careful where that technology then goes and be mindful of these export controls. We see these mistakes made, innocent mistakes oftentimes made all the time, of where they're, moving equipment, say, from one country to another. You know, maybe it was in Vietnam and now they're moving it to China, and all of a sudden there's an export control violation because they didn't realize what had been commingled together in their equipment or their software. The other area where this is coming up, if you're an investor and you're investing in a large company has a big integrated supply chain, and understanding the risks and how much quality control there is in the export control management of that company, because these end up, just like banks have to focus on anti-money laundering controls, if you're investing in a large manufacturer or a large software developer that has a lot of supply chains, or say AI being one of the biggest areas, you really have to be careful to make sure the company's managing its supply chain well.
Right. And so how thoroughly are U.S. authorities willing to enforce these sanctions? And, what is the jurisdiction there for them to enforce sanctions like export control sanctions on European companies? How can they legally enforce them on companies that are not U.S. companies? Yeah.
So there are the main penalties, say levers of influence the U.S. has here, are there's financial penalties, but also being denied the right to receive U.S. exports. So if you're caught and seen as violating these export control rules, you may be cut off from the U.S. markets. And the U.S. has been enforcing these for years against European companies. This was seen most actively in sort of the defense supply chain space, where U.S. companies were importing things from Europe, but European companies weren't controlling the origin of their technology. And so then European companies started being fined and sanctioned by the U.S. Commerce Department. And the State Department also has authorities here when it comes to purely defensive equipment or military equipment.
Okay, so and obviously when it comes to China-U.S. Trade tensions, also the trade tariffs were, hit the headlines, for many months, this tit-for-tat exchange of trade tariffs between Washington and Beijing. It's interesting, speaking to different sources around the globe, there seems to be a perception that there are ways to get around these tariffs through, for example, the use of free zones. Example, a country that could have, in Latin America, that could have a bilateral trade agreement with the U.S. They are trying to speak to Chinese investors to lure them into building up a factory in their free trade zone, special economic zones, to then re-export their goods onto the U.S. markets. But also countries in Asia, they are trying to do the same with American investors, telling them, if you want to get around Chinese sanctions, set up a factory here, set up a local branch, a subsidiary in this country, in these special economic zones, you get all the incentives, you can also re-export duty-free to China. Does it make sense? Do you think that these mechanisms to get around sanctions can work?
Well, sure. These sort of mechanisms can be useful for getting around trade restrictions, and tariffs. I mean, you see this as sort of changing the rules of origin. If you're adding value in these different free zones, yes, you can effectively rebrand a Chinese product, a Vietnamese product, or otherwise. But that really has to do with customs rules more than anything.
Yeah.
In terms of sanctions, there is not really evasion by relocating your manufacturing. What sanctions look at is who is the owner. Who's the operator? Who are the parties involved? So if a sanction, let's say a Russian oligarch who's been sanctioned is changing his factory location from outside of Moscow to Czech Republic. That doesn't change the fact that those products are still sanctioned,
sure.
or you know, if you're an investor, you can't invest in that company. So that's one of the things you have to look at is, you know, overly complicated structuring tends to be a red flag when you're looking at sanctions and separating out the issue of sort of customs mitigation versus sanctions mitigation.
Absolutely. So obviously, yeah, they are part of the same, in a way, foreign policy effort, yeah. But they are two very different things, trade tariffs and, you know, more frontal sanctions, treasury sanctions, yeah. or exports control sanctions. Another, obviously, very aggressive sanctions program is the program against Iran. Since the United States withdrew from the nuclear deal, they ramped up sanctions against Tehran and primary and secondary sanctions. And actually, we have already mentioned this before, but in this case, you know, the focus on secondary sanctions seems to be key. Also, because it's interesting to see that during in those couple of years when the U.S. were on board the nuclear deal, still, American investors didn't really invest in Iran because still primary sanctions were in place for them. So there were still very high restrictions for American U.S.-based right. companies to invest into Iran, which was not the case, obviously, for European yeah. companies. Whereas now, the U.S. reintroduced secondary sanctions, which means that they are trying to enforce their sanctions program also on non-U.S. Companies. So tell us more about this and how European companies, anyway, in a way, can deal with this or should deal with this also in a situation where European countries, the European Union, but the other countries that were part of the deal, the UK, Germany, and France, are trying to set up a mechanism or a scheme to circumvent these sanctions.
Yeah. I mean, the short answer is dealing with Iran from a U.S. sanctions perspective, is incredibly dangerous, even for non-U.S. companies. The U.S. has made imposing aggressive sanctions, so-called maximum pressure against Iran, a key foreign policy plank, and is enforcing it. If you're a European company and want to trade with Iran, nothing you can do can go through the U.S. system, you know, no U.S. banks, none of that. But even avoiding the U.S. system, if you're not careful, looks like sanctions evasion, which is punishable itself and can attract secondary sanctions. So really making a choice to deal with Iran, you have to manage the fact that you may never be totally cut off from the U.S. system because of, you know, the way you have to structure your own products, but also you may not be ever allowed back into the U.S. banking system if yeah. you're not careful. And it's a risk that really has to be assessed. Lots of lawyers, you know, plug for us, but, you know, lots of lawyers have to look at it. And I think most times you're going to find it's a bad idea that if you're worried about the sanctions impact in the U.S., if you're worried about being, you know, having access to the U.S. market and the U.S. banking system and, frankly, the global financial system, dealing with Iran is incredibly challenging. And, you know, the European Union has, you know, passed this blocking legislation that's supposed to protect protect European companies from U.S. sanctions. I think the reality is America doesn't care and we'll still go after that. And then it becomes a bit of a, you know, foreign policy fight between European and the EU and the U.S. But it is not a sort of safe bet. That's what the thing that the European Union is going to protect a business from U.S. sanctions. The EU is trying this special purpose vehicle to at least allow some types of transactions to go through.
If I'm not mistaken.
Right. But that's also fairly limited. It's taken far too long than everyone thought to launch it. I don't even think it's fully operational yet. But also, I believe it's limited to sort of humanitarian goods, medicines and food, which, you know, is good for a small part of the market, but not for most of it. So it's not a catch-all. You can't use it to sell cars to Iran. And so you're falling out into the global market. And I think that's what you're finding is that the banks, even the non-U.S. banks, are effectively the enforcement arm of the U.S. government. They don't want to process these transactions relating to Iran. So even if what you come up with some type of transaction that isn't a violation of U.S. sanctions, the banks themselves may not even want to go anywhere near it because it's not worth it for them to process an Iran transaction even one that may not violate sanctions, because they don't want to deal with the risk of being cut off from the U.S. system.
Absolutely. And actually, there are a couple of big examples of banks, French banks, that have been heavily sanctioned for their dealings with not just Iran, Cuba, but, you know, an overall sort of attitude in a breach of sanctions, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yeah.
BNP Paribas and Société Générale, billion-dollar sanctions.
Oh, yeah, billions of dollars in fines. It's not worth it. I mean, this was, and the U.S. understands this, and the Treasury Department fans out around the world and talks to these banks and explains to them the consequences of processing these types of transactions. So it, you know, becomes just not worth it for them. It's not a big enough business to even necessarily invest in a sort of high-end compliance system to figure out what could work and what cannot work. It's just it's easier just to drop the wall.
And when it comes to business, obviously, I guess it's a no-brainer. You know, the risk of losing the U.S. market to access the Iranian market. It sounds very cynical, but from a business perspective, probably the answer is pretty straightforward.
Absolutely. There's plenty of other countries to make money in.
Yeah. Matt, a very last question. Huawei. Again, this is a bit more kind of, I think that the line here is a bit grayer in a way that there is a big policy push to prevent Huawei, but not just Huawei, other Chinese 5G equipment suppliers to develop their 5G networks in Europe as elsewhere. But there are many countries that are still trying to move forward because Huawei has got like a bigger competitive edge in terms of technology vis-a-vis any other supplier, and countries, they don't want to miss on the 5G opportunity, which is should be kind of backbone of things like Industry 4.0, the Internet of Things, and so on and so forth. But in this case, as far as I'm aware, there is not a clear sanctions program, at least outside the US. I know that obviously Huawei has got big troubles doing business in the US, if not, has been totally blacklisted. But give us a bit of background here and whether or not companies and authorities elsewhere outside the US should feel their hands free when dealings with Huawei.
Right. I think there's sort of three ways to look at this as the sort of the importer of Huawei technology, the exporter of Huawei technology, and the investor in Huawei. If you're someone who's selling into Huawei, you know, chips, routers, whatever widget or software you're selling to Huawei, if you're part of the U.S. supply chain, if you've got U.S. equipment, as we talked about earlier around export controls, you have to be really careful.
Red flag.
Big red flag, big investigation, sort of figure out what you're doing and what you're allowed to do. If you're, you know, a German company importing Huawei technology for either your company or if you're the state, for that matter, thinking about, you know, giving Huawei access to your build of your 5G network, you know, that's another question. The U.S. has made it a foreign policy priority, and that's going to expand. I think if you start seeing countries really go big on Huawei technology in critical infrastructure, the U.S. may deploy other policy weapons, whether it's sanctions, export controls, other things that the U.S. has in its arsenal to sort of protest that, to try to block it, to try to undermine it, cutting off financing from U.S. banks, all these other things. You could see the way the U.S. has talked, you know, tried to handle Russian pipelines as an example of the kind of tools it would deploy against Huawei. And look, these countries, whether it's the UK or Germany or elsewhere, have to make fundamental national security assessments about whether Huawei is safe. I'm not a tech expert, so I can't answer that, but these are other ones. The third one I'd be looking at is, you know, if you're an investor in Huawei, it's the same question I'd be asking if you're investing in any Chinese tech company, is what's their potential exposure to sanctions and export controls? It's one thing to say, oh, this is a cool company and they make an interesting product and there's 3 billion possible customers. I want to invest in it. And maybe their core technology or their core product is perfectly benign and fine. But Chinese companies, many of them are state-owned, they're state-influenced, they're in so many different corners. Is there something else they're doing? Are they operating in some geography? Do they have a subsidiary that actually is carrying out some kind of trade with North Korea? Or they have some subsidiary that's, you know, handling an oil trade with Iran that you have to be worried about? So I think understanding the holistics of a Chinese company about what it does and where it operates is so important as an investor doing your due diligence, because you might think you're buying, you know, some cool, you know, solar technology, but then you find out, oh, you know, there's a subsidiary manufacturing that solar technology in a no-no country, you know, from the U.S. perspective.
So bottom line of all this, if you're dealing, if you got any doubt, don't forget to call your lawyer.
Absolutely.
For moving forward. Well, Matt, thank you very much for this very insightful discussion. Where people can find you, where people can find your law firm, how people can get in touch.
Sure. I'm Matthew Orsman. I'm at Pillsbury Winthrop. We're a global law firm with 21 offices around the world. I'm just down the street and from you and by the Bank of England. But, please find us at pillsburylaw.com. And my name again, Matthew Orsman.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again, Matt. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. You can find all our podcasts on fdiintelligence.com/podcasts or on iTunes and Acast. Thanks.